Chapter 11. Misunderstood. Mike had refused to accompany Smith to the meeting that evening, saying that he got too many chances in the ordinary way of business of hearing Mr. Bickersdyke speak without going out of his way to make more. So Smith had gone off to Kenningford alone, and Mike, feeling too lazy to sally out to any place of entertainment, had remained at the flat with a novel. He was deep in this when there was the sound of a key in the latch, and shortly afterwards Smith entered the room. On Smith's brow there was a look of pensive care and also a slight discoloration. When he removed his overcoat, Mike saw that his collar was burst and hanging loose, and that he had no tie. On his erstwhile speckless and gleaming shirt front were a number of finger impressions of a boldness and clearness of outline which would have made a Bertillon expert leap with joy. "Hello," said Mike, dropping his book. Smith nodded in silence, went to his bedroom, and returned with a looking-glass. Propping this up on a table, he proceeded to examine himself with the utmost care. He shuddered slightly as his eye fell on the finger marks, and without a word he went into his bathroom again. He emerged after an interval of 10 minutes in sky-blue pyjamas, slippers, and an old Etonian blazer. He lit a cigarette, and, sitting down, stared pensively into the fire. "What the dickens have you been playing at?" demanded Mike. Smith heaved a sigh. "That," he replied, "I could not say precisely. At one moment it seemed to be rugby football, at another a jiu-jitsu seance. Later, it bore a resemblance to a pantomime rally. However, whatever it was all very bright and interesting, a distinct experience." "You mean scrapping?" asked Mike. "What happened? Was there a row?" "There was," said Smith, "in a measure, what might be described as a row. At least, when you find a perfect stranger attaching himself to your collar and pulling, you begin to suspect that something of that kind is on the bill." "Did they do that?" Smith nodded. "A merchant in a moth-eaten bowler started warbling to a certain extent with me. It was all very trying for a man of culture. He was a man who had, I should say, discovered that alcohol was a food long before the doctors found it out. A good chap, possibly, but a little boisterous in his manner." "Well, well." Smith shook his head sadly. "He got you one on the forehead," said Mike, "or somebody did. Tell us what happened. I wish the dickens I'd come with you. I'd no notion there'd be a rag of any sort. What did happen?"
"Comrade Jackson," said Smith sorrowfully, "how sad it is in this life of ours to be consistently misunderstood. You know, of course, how wrapped up I am in Comrade Bickersdyke's welfare. You know that all my efforts are directed towards making a decent man of him, that, in short, I am his truest friend. Does he show by so much as a word that he appreciates my labours? Not he. I believe that man's beginning to dislike me, Comrade Jackson.
What happened, anyhow? Never mind about Bickersdyke.
Perhaps it was mistaken zeal on my part.
Well, I will tell you all. Make a long arm for the shovel, Comrade Jackson, and pile on a few more coals. I thank you. Well, all went quite smoothly for a while. Comrade B, in quite good form, got his second wind and was going strong for the tape, when a regrettable incident occurred. He informed the meeting that while up in the lake country, fishing, he went to an inn and saw a remarkably large stuffed trout in a glass case. He made inquiries and found that 5 separate and distinct people had caught—"
"Why, dash it all," said Mike, "that's a frightful chestnut."
Smith nodded. "It certainly has appeared in print," he said. "In fact, I should have said it was rather a well-known story. I was so interested in Comrade Bickersdyke's statement that the thing had happened to himself that, purely out of goodwill towards him, I got up and told him that I thought it was my duty, as a friend, to let him know that a man named Jerome had pinched his story, put it in a book, and got money by it. Money, mark you, that should by rights have been Comrade Bickersdyke's. He didn't appear to care much about sifting the matter thoroughly. In fact, he seemed anxious to get on with his speech and slur the matter over. but tactlessly, perhaps, I continued rather to harp on the thing. I said that the book in which the story had appeared was published in 1889. I asked him how long ago it was that he'd been on his fishing tour, because it was important to know, in order to bring the charge home against Jerome. Well, after a bit, I was amazed, and pained, too, to hear Comrade Bickersdyke urging certain bravos in the audience to turn me out. If ever there was a case of biting the hand that fed him. Well, well, by this time the meeting had begun to take sides to some extent. What I might call my party, the earnest investigators, were whistling between their fingers, stamping on the floor, and shouting chestnut, while the opposing party, the bravos, seemed to be trying, as I say, to do jiu-jitsu tricks with me. It was a painful situation. I know the cultivated man of affairs should have passed the thing off with a short, careless laugh, but owing to the above-mentioned alcohol expert having got both hands under my collar, short, careless laughs were off. I was compelled, very reluctantly, to conclude the interview by tapping the bright boy on the jaw. He took the hint and sat down on the floor. I thought no more of the matter, and was making my way thoughtfully to the exit, when a second man of wrath put the above on my forehead. You can't ignore a thing like that. I collected some of his waistcoat and one of his legs and hove him with some vim into the middle distance. By this time a good many of the earnest investigators were beginning to join in, and it was just there that the affair began to have certain points of resemblance to a pantomime rally. Everybody seemed to be shouting a good deal and hitting everybody else. It was no place for a man of delicate culture, so I edged towards the door and drifted out. There was a cab in the offing. I boarded it. And having kicked a vigorous politician in the stomach as he was endeavouring to climb in too, I drove off home. Smith got up, looked at his forehead once more in the glass, sighed and sat down again. "All very disturbing," he said. "Great Scott," said Mike, "I wish I'd come. Why on earth didn't you tell me you were going to rag? I think you might as well have done. I wouldn't have missed it for worlds." Smith regarded him with raised eyebrow. "Rag?" he said. "Comrade Jackson, I do not understand you. You surely do not think that I had any other object in doing what I did than to serve Comrade Bickersdyke? It's terrible how one's motives get distorted in this world of ours." "Well," said Mike with a grin, "I know one person who'll jolly well distort your motives, as you call it, and that's Bickersdyke." Smith looked thoughtful. "True," he said, "true. There is that possibility. I tell you, Comrade Jackson, once more, that my bright young life is being slowly blighted by the frightful way in which that man misunderstands me. It seems almost impossible to try to do him a good turn without having the action misconstrued. What'll you say to him tomorrow? I shall make no allusion to the painful affair. If I happen to meet him in the ordinary course of business routine, I shall pass some light, pleasant remark, on the weather, let's say, or the bank rate, and continue my duties. How about if he sends for you and wants to do the light, pleasant remark business on his own? In that case, I shall not thwart him. If he invites me into his private room, I shall be his guest, and shall discuss, to the best of my ability, any topic which he may care to introduce. There shall be no constraint between Comrade Bickersdyke and myself." "No, I shouldn't think there would be. I wish I could come and hear you." "I wish you could," said Smith courteously. "Still, it doesn't matter much to you. You don't care if you do get sacked." Smith rose. "In that way, possibly, as you say, I am agreeably situated. If the new Asiatic Bank does not require Smith's services, there are other spheres where a young man of spirit may carve a place for himself. No, what is worrying me, Comrade Jackson, is not the thought of the push. It is the growing fear that Comrade Bickersdyke and I will never thoroughly understand and appreciate one another. A deep gulf lies between us. I do what I can to bridge it over, but he makes no response. On his side of the gulf, building operations appear to be at an entire standstill. That is what is carving these lines of care on my forehead, Comrade Jackson. That is what is painting these purple circles beneath my eyes.
quite inadvertently to be disturbing Comrade Bickersdyke, annoying him, preventing him from enjoying life. How sad this is. Life bulges with these tragedies. Mike picked up the evening paper.
Don't let it keep you awake at night, he said. By the way, did you see that Manchester United were playing this afternoon? They won. You'd better sit down and sweat up some of the details. You'll want them tomorrow.
You are very right, Comrade Jackson, said Smith, reseating himself.
So the Mancunians pushed the bulb into the meshes beyond the uprights no fewer than four times, did they? Bless the dear boys. What spirits they do enjoy, to be sure. Comrade Jackson, do not disturb me. I must concentrate myself. These are deep waters.